Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens all around New York City and the surrounding area. And today, we're a little bit mournful. We lost David Bowie. It's a little sad.
It is a sad day.
Yeah, a little trippy friend. So I just wanted to...
The star is back in the sky.
Yeah.
The star man.
Among all the other star men. So today we're going to talk about China again. China, the Mother of Gardens, is a little mini-series that Alice and I are doing about the plants of China. And one of the plants that we decided to focus on are camellias.
Because we love them.
We love them. And in some places, they're blooming right now.
Yes.
In the south.
If you're fortunate.
If you're very fortunate. And even though we've had...
Depending on the temperature in the north.
Right, exactly.
I think Sunday they might have been blooming. Today, not.
No, that was... I'm really feeling... My body is like going through this like weird reaction to this bipolar weather. Like one day it's 60 and you're like, you know... frolicking in flip-flops, and the next minute today is like 10 degrees and it's going to be really interesting to see, Alice, like how the plants are going to react. And I've been doing some reading on that.
Forsythia is in bloom Central Park.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, and trees are in bud, and so it's going to be an interesting spring to sit, and we're going to see. We still have February to get through.
Do you hear that, clients? Interesting spring. We are not responsible
for bipolar weather. Just saying. So camellias are timely. You know, it's spring or fall blooming plants. So for the first part of the show, we're going to talk about an economic camellia. And in the second part of the show, we're going to talk about ornamental camellias with our special guest, Bree Glovna Arthur, who's been on the show before. So the first plant is Camellia sinensis, which basically means of China. Sinensis means Chinese. And that is... the tea plant.
Yes.
That is the economic plant.
That changed the world.
That changed the world in so many different ways. It's such an interesting story. And we can only really touch on sort of like the highlights, but there's so much interesting stuff that I want to share with you. Now, we chose camellia, as I said, for some of the reasons, but one of the reasons is personal. Okay. I have a special relationship
this is a great
with tea.
Story.
And I don't, have I told you this story before?
I have heard the story. Yep.
Anyway, when I was in high school in ninth grade, we were assigned this social studies project of some cultural significance, something to do with culture. So I chose from the list of topics the Japanese tea ceremony. So being in New York and pre-internet, I had to figure out how to, you know, find out about the tea ceremony.
Did you use the Dewey Decimal System, Carmen?
I did. I did use the Dewey Decimal System. And after some research at the library...
Where books are.
Where books are.
Real books.
Real books. I spent a lot of time in the library. I found out that there was a Japanese tea ceremony school associated with the UN in New York. So I had my dad take me there to meet this old Japanese man who was the director. And he spent hours talking to me and explaining to me about the ceremony. And, you know, it was just an amazing, amazing thing for a 14-year-old kid to experience, you know.
While and at the UN.
At the UN. Well, my dad waited in the car. My dad had, like, my dad had actually been to Asia a bunch of times. He had no interest in hanging out with the man. He'd probably been to ceremonies, you know.
Yeah.
So he waited in the car because he refused to pay for parking. And I...
like the real New Yorker that he is.
The real New Yorker that he is. And he goes, you go in there and you talk to the man. I was like, okay, you know. So he was...
I'm going to drive around first. First Avenue for a while.
Yeah. You know, so he probably listened to like WQXR and, you know. Anyway, so there I was, and I was just blown away. I really like loved the experience of like interviewing somebody and asking all these questions, and he was so generous. Not only did he answer my questions, take all that time, but he also gave me a bowl mm-hmm. and a whisk that had been given to him by his instructor, and some powdered matcha tea.
Uh-huh.
And I still have it to this day, and it's like one of my most treasured possessions, because it was kind of like a turning point for me when I became officially a nerd. Like when I officially became a nerd.
No, I mean he expanded your horizons.
Oh, and that's, yes.
That is a gift.
Oh, it was incredible. So then I grabbed some dresses that my dad had brought from China. We were just like cross-cultural, you know, that we didn't have Japanese, you know, yeah. garb.
Yeah.
My friends and I did the ceremony. Of course, we got A's, uh-huh. you know, and it was just such a great moment for me
yeah.
from a educational point of view. I was like, right. wow, this is really what learning is about.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a fun,
yeah.
great moment. So that's why tea to me is so important. And I associate, I don't know how you feel about it, Alice, but like I associate coffee with fuel
uh-huh.
and tea with relaxing.
Yeah, yeah, the same.
I'm kind of like...
For me, it was like Prevention Magazine 1982 when I started reading Prevention, and I was all into like health and fitness,
yeah.
you know, 10th grade, 9th grade.
Yeah.
And I really started drinking tea, green tea,
yeah.
for like yeah. health benefits. But I remember doing it after dinner with my mom, and it was a very nice moment of yeah. of our day, you know?
Yeah. So despite my introduction to tea from the Japanese tradition, we're going to talk about tea because from the Chinese perspective, because China invented tea.
I mean,
it's a Chinese invention, and it's part of their culture and history for so long that when I was doing research for the show, the history's a little bit kind of misty. There's a legend of
yes.
how tea began, right? According to legend, and I got this from the official Chinese website, china.org. Okay, so bear with me. All right. The first drops of tea were consumed by the Chinese emperor Chen Yang. And this is what the website says about it. Chen Yang, whose name means the divine farmer, which is great, is considered the Chinese father of agriculture. He's honored with the discovery of tea. According to the legend, one fall afternoon, Shen Yang decided to take a rest under a camellia tree and boil some water to drink. Dried leaves from the tree above floated down into the pot of boiling water and infused with the water, creating a pot of tea, marking the first ever infusion of the tea leaf. Intrigued by the delightful fragrance, Shen Yang took a sip and found it refreshing. That's the legend of tea. Now, it became really popular in the Buddhist monasteries after they discovered that the caffeine was able to keep the monks awake during their long hours of meditation.
Right.
So, for that reason, many monasteries also cultivated vast tea fields. Now, there's a lot of treatises on tea, some of them very old, and one of the earliest is by Lu Yi. He's the author of The Book of Tea, and Lu Yi was an orphan brought up and educated in a monastery. And the Chinese believe that it's likely that his experience growing up surrounded by these tea gardens inspired the book written during the Tang Dynasty. And in it, he records all the detailed ways of how to cultivate and prepare tea, all the tea drinking customs of the time, the best water for tea brewing, and all the different classifications of tea. Now, the Chinese had a virtual monopoly on the plant for centuries, and they used it for medicinal purposes as well as spiritual and pleasurable uses. According to the Little Book of Tea, which I use extensively as a resource for my research, Camellia sinensis is the only species of tea grown today, and it consists of two main varieties, China and Assam, and also a number of hybrids. And I found this really interesting because when I was imagining the tea plant, I was imagining something kind of like the camellias that we grow mm-hmm. here, you know, but they look very similar. But for example, the Chinese tea plant grows 6 to 9 feet high, but it can live for over 100 years or more, which I found really astounding. The awesome plant, by comparison, can grow 60 feet high. Now, I've never seen a camellia that tall.
No.
And it lives about half as long as the Chinese, about 50 years. So for cultivation purposes, though, that doesn't make it very practical to be able to pick the leaves off a 60-foot tall plant.
You gotta have a giraffe.
Yeah. So they prune them into these amazing, like, 3 to 4 foot tall shrubs that are beautiful and sort of almost like cloud pruning that the Japanese mm-hmm. do. And then they keep them at that height for ease of harvesting. And then they're grown, they take cuttings from the actual shrubs, and they grow them in these nurseries that are covered with the branches of their own plant. These roofs are covered with plants. So it's kind of like a semi-shady kind of environment.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, yesterday I went for a walk. Right. And I posted this on Facebook. I went for a walk just to get out of the house, and it had been raining most of the day. I go and I pass by, just out of the blue, I see a new garden shop in my neighborhood, and it's owned by Chinese. And uh-huh. what is in there? A tea plant and camellias. Which was really bizarre.
The tea gods are looking down on you.
So I bought a tea plant, and it's actually in bloom. In bud, actually. So I'm going to try to grow it. So I'm going to see if I can actually grow some tea in Brooklyn. So I don't know if it's going to like the weather, because it likes a wet climate where they get about 80 inches of rain.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? A year.
Mm-hmm.
New York gets like 40 to 50. You know, so we'll see how we do. I don't know if I'll actually end up making tea. But it brought me back to my old friend Scott Appel, who used to always go to Chinatown and get all these great Chinese plants. And, like, I associate that with him. So I feel like he was smiling down on me yesterday. So they also like at least 5 or 6 hours of sunshine a day. So they want sun. They want lots of rain. They like bright days followed by rainy nights, and they also really like the sort of loose acidic soil and the winds of the higher altitudes where these plantations are.
Uh-huh.
Now, according to the writer Alan Stella, tea is now grown in over 40 countries and on every continent except Europe and Antarctica. And he said that China is no longer the top producer.
Right.
Okay, so how did that happen? Basically, a botanist and plant explorer had something to do with that. India is now surpassed China in the production of tea. So what happened in the 18th century, in the 17th century, is that Europeans sort of developed a taste for tea. But it was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And only the very wealthy sort of could afford it. So this group of merchants called the Tea Committee set out to change that and to make Britain the producer of its own tea and make a lot of people some fortunes in the process. So, at the time, the British were growing Camellia sinensis in India by the middle of the 19th century. But the tea that it produced was not of the highest quality. The Chinese jealously guarded their tea growing and brewing secrets, and it took some underhanded moves by the Tea Committee to solve these secrets. And this is how they did it. They sent the botanist Robert Fortune, who had already extensively explored China in previous expeditions hunting for plants. They sent him in 1848, first to the green tea regions, where he disguised himself as a Chinese merchant. And that's where he discovered that the quality of the water greatly affects the taste of tea. Now, that seems obvious to us, right?
Right.
Like, but at that period, pure water wasn't as readily available. So you can imagine what people brewed tea in, you know? So then he went back to China on another expedition. He went to the black tea regions disguised as a Mongolian mandarin accompanied by some Chinese co-conspirators.
I would have liked to have seen that costume.
I know. Well, when I was there's actually a movie made about Robert Fortune.
Yeah.
And that's where I found the image of this sort of like Caucasian man dressed in Chinese garb. It's not him, but it's somebody, you know. And I was like, how did he pull it off? I mean, did everyone have like really poor eyesight? Did he have makeup?
And, like, and what about the speech? I mean,
I know. Was he a mute, right? Like merchant?
How do you speak to a Mongolian like warrior and
yeah.
dupe that guy?
I know. You know. Maybe he, this just requires a little bit more research. Maybe he knew Mandarin. Who right. knows? You yeah. know, because he had been there before. But I just find it, when I picture 19th century British gentlemen,
right.
I don't think that they can pull off
Mandarin
or Mongolian merchants. Yeah. But you know what? Yeah. It worked because
Mongolian, right.
He was able to get 20,000 plants out of China secretly to Calcutta. And he also brought with him, this is really interesting, 85 Chinese tea experts. And they were very instrumental in helping the British set up the tea plantations in India and break the Chinese monopoly of tea. So that was really smart. Somehow he was able to convince. Now the Chinese have paid us back in spades. Like, they basically talk about industrial espionage. Like,
yeah.
you know, they've taken care of, they've gotten us back after those tea plants. So they're doing just fine for themselves. Anyway, so here's another thing that I found out that was really interesting about tea. And it makes me want to drink even more of it. Tea plantations that produce a tea that's not going to be mixed with any other type are called gardens.
Ah, I did not know
literally
that.
Literally no, called gardens. So the tea from these plantations often bears their name, such as St. James or Petiagala. These gardens are not necessarily small, though. They can range into the thousands of acres. And the harvesting on these plantations is done by hand, often by skilled women. And the tea is sold by weight, and it's whole leaf tea, not broken. I got quite a tea education during this research, and I basically found out that
it's more like a vineyard then.
Yeah, exactly. It's more like a vineyard than a farm, and the tea that I'm drinking is basically crap. You know, like after I read these books on tea, I'm like, oh my God, I'm drinking the worst possible tea. So it's going to elevate my tea taste. In the future.
No longer a teetotaler.
No longer a teetotaler. Anyway, Els, what kind of tea do you like to drink?
My favorite is Lapsang Souchong.
Okay.
Because of the earthy taste and smell of it, it's very, it's a black tea.
Yes.
And it reminds me of the smell of peat. And that's why I love it.
So it's kind of smoky.
It's kind of dirty and smoky. Yeah. And I love it. Lapsang Souchong.
Yes, that's featured in this book here.
Uh-huh.
I have to confess that sometimes all I want is a cup of Lipton. I know it sounds weird, but to me sometimes with honey and lemon, like
it is
the good old diner like tea.
Yeah,
is it really is. Fantastic.
And I'm a big fan of that too. But when I make myself a cup of tea at home, it's always Lapsang Souchong.
And is it loose leaf or is it?
Yeah, I buy it loose.
Okay.
And I'm sure it's not the best quality. I'm sure there's better qualities. You know, I'm just kind of going to Whole Foods or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Like Fairway and, you know.
No, well, that's already better. Yeah. And according to the tea snobs that I was reading about, you must never put into these good teas, you never put milk or sugar or lemon or anything.
I do put a little sugar in it.
Because it's pretty strong.
Yeah. I just like the sweetness.
Well, you're in the majority because most of the black tea is for the export market.
Oh.
The Chinese drink much more of the unfermented green and the white teas.
Yeah.
But the West really developed a taste for the black tea, and that's because the varieties that the British developed the taste for it.
Right.
So they liked that strong tannic flavor, and that's kind of what spread throughout the rest of Europe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of save some of the special stuff for themselves.
I have had some white jasmine tea that has been amazing at a Korean restaurant in Koreatown, and that was spectacular.
Well, you want to hear some interesting stats about how much tea is consumed? 2 billion cups of tea are drunk around the world every day. 2.5 million tons of tea are produced each year. And the tea brokers operate out of 3 commodity exchanges, which is really cool.
Wait, does it list where they are?
Yeah. There's Colombo in Sri Lanka. Which Ceylon is like one of the main places that tea is produced. London, Calcutta, and Colombo in Ceylon, or okay. now called Sri Lanka, are where the exchanges are. And can you guess, Alice, this is a good trivia question, can you guess which country in the world consumes more tea per capita than any other? And you might be surprised by the answer.
Australia.
Nope. Do you want to try again? You're close.
Canada.
No. Ireland.
Ireland. Ireland. Duh. Okay. Right.
I was
That's where I started really
drinking
like
tea. Drinking tea. Yes. So right. Ireland drinks 8 pounds per capita.
Uh-huh.
The closest, the next closest is the UK.
Uh-huh.
Which is like about 6.5 pounds.
Right.
But I was surprised to see that the Irish drink more tea than the Chinese.
Right. And they're not coffee drinkers at all. I mean, now they might be, but when I was there in Ireland, Nobody drank coffee. Now they're
Starbucks in Ireland.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I was shocked to, I mean, I guess per capita, right?
Uh-huh.
But I still thought that some country in Asia would surpass
yeah.
any British, but Ireland.
Yeah.
So, and then another interesting bit that I thought was fascinating was there are more gardens, tea gardens, you know, the one, mm-hmm. the actual cultivation areas in China than there are vineyards in France.
Oh.
Which
oh,
is
wow.
very...
Well, yeah, there's a lot more tea drinkers than...
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And now my new tea holy grail,
uh-huh.
my personal tea holy grail, I want to try Yin Zhen, which is called Silver Needles,
uh-huh.
right? It's a very special tea. It is only produced, it only harvests 2 days a year.
Oh.
That's it.
You got to dig deep into your pocketbook for that, my friend.
That's going to be an
get
expensive.
Get the clam knife out.
Get the clam knife out. But I now have developed, I want to taste this Silver Needles. I'm
yeah.
dying to taste it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think we have to take a break.
Yes. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the plant and the ornamental value.
Of camellias.
Of camellia.
Stay tuned.
It's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Hello, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking camellias and tea, and we're going to enter our segment concerning the ornamental camellia with a really great friend and grower, Bree Arthur. And let me tell you a little bit about Bree. She was on our show a couple of weeks ago talking about her...
Couple months ago?
In the fall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talking about her...
foodscaping.
Her foodscaping and her front yard agricultural experiment, grain experiment. So Bree is originally from southeastern Michigan. She studied landscape design at Purdue University before moving to North Carolina in 2002. She has worked in almost every aspect of horticulture with some of the most prestigious gardens and plant professionals in the country, including Montrose Gardens and Plant Delights Nursery. Bree is the foodscaping and landscape design correspondent on the PBS television series Growing a Greener World. She films from her one-acre suburban foodscape garden, giving practical advice on integrating edibles in a traditional ornamental landscape using an all-organic growing technique. Welcome, Bree.
Thank you for having me again, ladies.
Sure.
Our worlds were serendipitous, right? You were taught. You're about to give a series of lectures on camellias. We were looking for a camellia expert, and here we are.
It could not have been better timing.
So Alice and I just talked about Camellia sinensis, the tea plant. And it's a big genus, the camellias, right? There's like over 250 species and like so many different cultivars.
You're a grower, right? And a propagator?
Yeah, you've done both, right?
I have, yes, for 5 years at Camellia Forest. And, you know, it's amazing because most people call, the Sasanquas the fall bloomers, or they refer to them as the red one or the pink one. And they have no idea there are 25,000 registered Camellia japonica in the United States alone.
Oh my God.
It's a massive genus, and it's a range of plants that's had so much interest from flower shows to landscape value. And the breeding continues. It's just amazing to see what's happening even now. And it's something that's been being bred since 2726 BC.
Wow.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about that history, like which types Bree came from China, you know, and that have influenced our gardens here.
Well, all the species of camellia are native to Asia.
Okay.
Of course, tea is one of the oldest, so Camellia sinensis was originally from China mainland and was spread, you know, through Buddhist monks into Korea and over into Japan. But obviously, Camellia japonica does reign from the Japanese islands. Mm-hmm. And then Sasanquas are native predominantly to mainland China.
Okay.
And another important species that doesn't often get recognized is Camellia oleifera. And from a purposeful standpoint, this is the camellia that's used for oil production. So the seeds are actually pressed. And then the oils are used for a whole variety of different things, including using as light oil in rural areas of China. But for a breeding standpoint, Camellia oleifera is what has really raised the cold hardiness. So it's often used in hybridizing with japonicas and especially with Camellia sasanquas. So if you're familiar with any of the breeding work that Dr. Ackerman did through the National Arboretum, most of those are hybrid Sasanqua oleiferas, which have now the great cold hardiness of getting into zone 6A.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's the reason that we have the ones like Long Island Pink. That's one of the varieties that works well here in New York that actually made it through multiple horrible winters, Bree. That's one of the oleifera I'm familiar with because I think that was the oil that the geishas also used, right? It's a beauty oil, right? As well. And also very expensive. It's like insanely expensive, this oleifera as an oil.
Exactly.
So you you know a little bit of the history of the camellia. Can you tell us who it was named for and how it got introduced to the West?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting. Of course, Linnaeus did give it its name, and it's named for a scientist named Camel, spelled with a K, not a C, so it's not a literal translation. But it was actually the Dutch East India Company that is really ultimately responsible for moving camellias from the far West ultimately into Europe and then into the new American colonies. And tea, of course, was a really important part of that 16th, 17th century trade. Mm-hmm. But to avoid the colonization and making new tea plantations outside of China, the Chinese sent tens of thousands of ornamental seed off with the Dutch and ultimately spread the ornamental camellias that way. Now, it's actually really interesting because it was a man named Engelbert Kempter, who was a surgeon for the Dutch East India Company, brought the first ornamental camellia to Holland in 1692. And it was because he was just fascinated with it, hadn't really seen anything, showy, and mm-hmm. didn't quite understand what its purpose was. And it was grown all through Europe after that time as a conservatory plant, until later in the mid-1750s, when people discovered that it would live in the coastal climate of France. Mm-hmm. And it ultimately made Nantes, France, like a powerhouse in the cut flower trade in the late 19th century because it was a really popular plant for buttonhole decor. And it's an interesting statistic. On January 1st of 1888, 120,000 camellia flowers were sold in the halls of Paris for the purpose of men wearing as a lapel.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine 120,000 cut camellias in one day?
Yeah.
Wow.
I love the effect that plants can have, like, around the world, you know? It is, and what plants can spawn, you know? Think of, it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, from an economic, cultural, historical point of view, and it's so, the camellias, I mean, I'm picturing the Europeans first seeing them, right? Here's an evergreen shrub mm-hmm. that also flowers almost like a rose.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that must have been so interesting and amazing to them in a way, you know?
Well, it was. I mean, it was literally an indispensable complement for evening wear at Parisian parties. And the camellia was the favored flower by Coco Chanel. Uh-huh. And you will still see camellias show up in Chanel's lines even today.
Oh, I'm going to look for that.
Absolutely
green.
Amazing.
Yeah. She was particular to that flower.
She was particular to the formal double Camellia japonicas that became extremely popular in Europe. And during that time, they were breeding, for lots of layered petals, and they were introducing a virus so that it would become streaked. And that virus, of course, still continues today. So many of these heritage varieties, you'll have a plain, say, plain red or plain white flower. And then you'll have a tie-dyed version of it. And often the name just indicates variegated. And that's a viral-induced variegation that has no impact on the plant's ability to grow, but manifests through the flower coloration.
Ah. So, how, because I always think of the South and I think of camellias. So who brought it? Do you know? I know I'm kind of throwing a crazy question to you. Who brought it to the United States?
Well, interestingly enough, the first camellia came into the United States through Boston in the late 1700s. And it was again grown as a conservatory plant. Mm-hmm. But it quickly spread into the South, where conditions for growing outside were more convenient. And simultaneously, camellias became very popular on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And so that was actually a channel to be bringing camellias directly from Asia, specifically from Japan. Whereas on the East Coast and down into the Southeast and Deep South, most of those varieties were coming from Europe. So when you visit gardens in California and Oregon and Washington, their heritage camellias tend to have more of an Asian heritage, uh-huh. and the Deep South tends to have more of a French, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish influence.
Yeah.
Well, that's very different. And how does that manifest itself in how the plants look, Bree?
Well, often the Japanese varieties are a little bit of a simpler flower. They might be single, and you'll see the stamens, which are really ideal for pollinators. Mm-hmm. Whereas the European varieties were very, I want to use the word gaudy. They're still fabulous.
Yeah.
But, you know, lots of petals. You know, that's the formal double flower, the anemone flower, you know, just where you almost don't see any of the sexual parts of the flower at all. It's just so full of big, bodacious petals.
Overworked.
Yeah. But I love them all.
I thought I
knew how camellias looked and what they could do. And then I went to Charleston.
Yeah.
Right? And I went to Middleton Plantation.
Uh-huh.
Free.
Yep.
And I saw camellias there that were like mind-blowing, like on steroids, like hedges, you know, 15, 20 feet tall.
Yeah.
Covered in blooms. I was blown away. I'd never seen anything
really
like it.
They really are spectacular down in the Deep South. And it was Charleston, the gardens of Charleston, that inspired me to actually start producing these plants, because in today's plant market, you don't really have a lot of heritage plants represented. It's an industry that's really driven by new hybrids.
And yes.
Yeah.
I think that there could be a real loss, you know, particularly if these older specimens ever had to endure, you know, an extreme flood or some sort of, you know, weather extreme that could potentially put them in harm. Those plants could be lost forever, and I hate the idea of that.
Right.
So 4 years ago, I actually started propagating off of those specimens from Middleton and Magnolia Plantation, areas in Savannah, as a means of trying to preserve them and get them into gardens of today.
Uh-huh.
Well, tell me, how would you define a heritage cultivar, Brie? What is the sort of, is there a cutoff date, or is it some other characteristic or property that that makes it a heritage?
Well, my definition is pre-1900. So
okay.
If it was introduced through the International Camellia Society before 1900, that's my definition of heritage camellia. There's a lot of, you know, confusion about the term heritage and heirloom.
Right.
Basically, it just should mean something old-worldy. And, of course, something that isn't in today's production.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how easy are they to propagate, camellias?
Well, they're extremely easy if you have the right conditions. You know, from a commercial standpoint, you'd obviously want to stick cuttings. From a homeowner's perspective, you know, air layering is probably a better idea because you only need one plant.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas coming from a nursery, you're trying to get as many plants as possible, so you're sticking smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Air layering is a really, you know, wonderful option for home collectors. To be able to share with other enthusiasts and to be able to just get a plant from a particular specimen. And you would start an air layer in, you know, late winter, early spring when the sap is starting to rise.
Mm-hmm.
You do it relatively high up on the plant. And it will develop roots through the summer. And then by fall, you can remove it from the mother plant. And I generally recommend potting it up for a season before you put it in the ground, just to make sure that the roots are fully established.
And these heirloom sort of heritage breeds, what besides being old, what qualities do you think do they bring? Like, what genetic properties do they bring to their race, so to speak, to the gardens? And you know, how do they help?
Well, you know, I think part of the garden experience is having that connection to history. So a lot of these have really interesting stories. So there's one in particular that I was attracted to at Magnolia Plantation called Captain Martin's Favorite.
And I love it.
It's an absolutely gorgeous, you know, formal double candy stripe plant that, you know, you just kind of stop dead in your tracks when you see it. But the reason it was named that, he was a river captain, so he would bring supplies two or three times a week up the Ashley River to the Magnolia Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was in flower, he would fill his top hat with the blooms to bring home to his wife.
Aww.
And one day, the lady of the house, Mrs. Julia Drayton, passed by, and he had to tip his hat. And the flowers came pouring out. And
that's
they
great.
Decided to name it for him because she was so charmed that he was attached to this plant in that way.
Right. Right.
That's a great
what
story.
What a great story.
That is.
I love your...
I think it's stories like that that connect you to a garden and to an experience and to a time past that isn't really all that different from what we go through every day now. And, you know, I think it's those stories that can get lost with the new plants movement because we aren't privy to the breeder information and how a name came about.
Right.
The trademark that it's been assigned.
And, right.
You know, so there's just a charm about these heritage plants. Just imagining shipping these plants. They had to live 3 months on a boat to cross the Atlantic, you mm-hmm. know, in the late 1700s. It's just a feat that they even got here alive, let right. alone continue to live today.
And also people, you know, the horticultural knowledge just wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was a lot of trial and error in figuring wow. out how they should be cultivated and what would be a, you know, successful soil and conditions. You know, there was a lot of loss, I'm sure, as well.
Oh, incredible amounts of loss. And I mean, tea is really a plant that can speak to that well, considering there's only one large tea plantation still in existence from the colonial times. You know, that was a plant that didn't necessarily translate in mass to the southern colonies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it never became it never became a good economic crop.
Not for here. No.
Not for here.
We just don't quite have the cool nights and the, yeah. well, particularly in the South, in the low country, we yeah. have very boggy soil. I swear this area should be called New Holland. Where I live, the water table is about a quarter inch under the soil surface.
Oh my
and
God.
Camellias hate wet feet.
Yeah.
So let's get into that a little bit, Bree. What does it take to grow camellias successfully? Can you give our listeners some tips?
I can. So my former boss, David Parks, the owner of Camellia Forest, used to say this to everyone, particularly in colder climates, which I would consider Central North Carolina to be a little bit outside of the camellia belt. We're just about 10 degrees too cold. But what you want to do is site your camellias on the north side of a south-facing border. And so what that means is that in the winter, when the sun is low in the sky, going to be in mostly shade. Mostly shade also means that it's going to be protected from cold winter winds, will be protected from early morning sun. So after you've had a hard frost, if the sun shines on the leaves right away, they can blister.
Yes.
But in the summer, when the sun is higher in the sky, that means that it's getting at least a part day full sun. And they need full sun in the summer to be able to set good buds.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what people often do, they plant it, and for 10 years it does great, and then they say, my camellia stopped blooming, what fertilizer do I need? And generally my recommendation is to trim up some of your trees, expose it to more daylight, because daylight really is the trigger for bud set.
Ah, okay.
Okay, good
that,
to know.
That is, because I've had that same situation where I've had some really good years, and then,
yeah,
you know, not.
North side of a south-facing border. If you can imagine what that condition is, you probably can zone bend with nearly every broadleaf evergreen, and especially with winter-blooming camellias.
Well, you've given me new hope, Bree.
So, that's my goal in life, to give hope to people that want to encourage horticulture.
And Bree, thank you. I just want to say once again, thank you for all of your work, because your work is really inspirational, and your enthusiasm and your love of history just is
a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch the projects that you're involved with.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I appreciate that positive feedback very, very much.
And Bree, just before we leave, plug your website and
the lectures that you're giving.
Some of the projects that you're doing.
Yeah, on the camellias especially.
Okay. My website is breegrows.com. And the Heritage Collection, you can come and see me give this inspirational talk about history and the role camellias play tomorrow, actually, at the North Carolina Green and Growing Trade Show. It'll also be presented at the Williamsburg Gardening Symposium.
Ah, perfect place for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm thrilled about that. That is late April. And, well, multiple other places, all of which are available on my website.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks for joining us again, Bree. We hope to see you in the flesh very soon.
Exactly. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Bree.
Okay, speak soon. So the show's been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, or follow us on Twitter at We Dig Plants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows, and of course on Instagram at Groundworks Gardens NYC.
Thanks for listening.
See you in the garden. Virtual garden.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.